So welcome to Secure in Mind. I have a very special guest and I'm sitting in his office today on a very terrible rainy day in Paris. Nonetheless, it was a beautiful weekend and I'm very, very happy to be here with him. I'm going to let him introduce himself. This is going to be a very, I think a very interesting discussion. It's slightly out of my ballpark. It's not as tech related, but I'll try and see if I can manage to tie in a security theme nonetheless. So, who am I speaking to?
John W.H. Denton, Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce. I always use my initials because when I was at school, I was ferociously bullied for my middle names, which are Wallace Hope, and I wear them like a badge of honour just to
as
annoy everyone. It's called a punch in the face.
I thought Martin was bad, but no.
Wallace Hope, which is actually quite funny because people often talk about an absence of hope, and I would say, I'm anything but that. I'm just a completely hopeful person.
Well, you turned it around.
It's good, yeah. No, it's good to be here. Thanks for having us.
No worries.
Welcome to Paris. Here it is, a shocker. But I'm told this is May.
Yeah.
Given we're in June, it's a problem.
Yeah, one of the benefits about climate change and, you know, going into a heap of fiery mess is that we'll get a couple of nice summers out of it. So
yeah, we've just been talking about climate change, actually. We're about to fly off to Rio de Janeiro. We have a World Chambers Congress, which brings together our group, which is an agglomeration of all the chambers of commerce, which is really like 36 million businesses.
And wow.
When we kind of agglomerate the ICC, we're the institutional representative of 45 million businesses. So this is a big crowd. But one thing we're doing there is we're initiating a pledge on action on climate.
Yeah.
And it's very much in the front line of Guterres at the moment, because what we're seeking to do is bring scale to the Paris Agreement, to the ambition.
Yep.
Which is much less than 2 degrees, in line with an aspiration of 1.5, mm-hmm. which is interesting because I've just been noticing how a lot of people have been dumbing down Paris to say that the actual commitment was to 2 degrees. It was no such thing.
No, it wasn't.
It was to action substantially less than 2 degrees. Mm. And yet it's interesting how the mantra has become, 2 degrees is what we committed to, no more. But that's not what they committed to. Mm. So we're reminding people of that. Anyway, my executive board at the ICC is signed off, and it's a pretty powerful board. The World Chambers Federation Executive Council signed off.
Yep.
And we'll be launching that action on climate change as one of our campaigns this year.
Okay, and as far as a campaign, I mean, we'll touch on this and then we'll go back and get an understanding of...
Yeah, I kind of jumped all there, didn't
that's,
I?
Yeah, but, no, that's fine. Yeah. And it's a very pertinent point. Without the climate, then we're all buggered. So a question: when you say that you're committing to actions, how can you enforce those actions? I mean, can you work with authorities to legislate these actions and penalise, etc.? Part of the plan?
Well, I mean, maybe I'll take a step back and just give you a little 2 minutes worth on ICC. So we're celebrating our centennial at the moment. So we were founded in 1919.
Yep.
We were founded on the basis that business is a force for good. Business, when it's encouraged and enabled, can lead to peace, prosperity, and opportunity for all. Mm-hmm. That's actually our DNA. It's we're in a way the last remaining thread of the League of Nations concept.
Okay.
We started in a very focused way in the Northern Hemisphere with major industrialists, but we're now, as I said, the institutional representative of 45 million businesses in the developed and the developing world, in the north and in the south. Actually, our membership employs more than 1 billion workers. So one in three worker in the world relies on the success of the membership of the ICC. So it's
a small deal.
It's a great responsibility. What we're able to do because of our independence and our integrity. So we're a purpose-led organization.
Yep.
We enable business worldwide to secure peace, prosperity, and opportunity for all.
Yep.
The people who are our members align to that purpose.
Yeah.
So they align with us. They seek to ascribe to that. that's what we represent, and that's why it's important for us to be described as a purpose-led. That's our purpose. Okay. The reason I said that is that because we're actually independent, we have integrity and we have authority. The benefit of those three is that we actually set norms.
Mm.
So if you think about it, at the end of the First World War, one of the great challenges was actually how do you enable global commerce, because there were inconsistent provisions operating, yeah, things like that. So the founders of the ICC worked out in a way how to create common standards, norms, which people could rely upon, provisions they could use. They turned it into ultimately a thing called Incoterms, which you might have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So international commercial terms. We do that sort of stuff. These are the tools that enable business. So we create public goods or curate public commons for business. So we're able to do that and no one else can do that. And then over a period of time, we also added something else we thought was missing, was that to actually have international commerce, you needed to have to be able to settle disputes.
Okay.
So we created the, and what is now seen as the world's leading private arbitral body, which is the ICC Courts of Arbitration, which range from commercial disputes, frankly, to investor-state disputes. So it's a pretty whiz-bang crowd here. So when you say, when we talk about these things, we're actually able to create norms and standards.
Yeah.
We're also able to govern because we can actually have accountability.
Yeah.
So the ICC governance, when you say we're going to apply ICC governance to an area, and we're looking, by the way, digital at the moment, because there's a lot of interest in the ICC availing itself of an opportunity to lead on the governance around digital, because governments are not going to be able to get their act together globally. The idea of a WTO curated a global agreement at the moment is probably beyond the next little while. So what's going to happen in between? And so the thinking is maybe an organization like ICC. So we're looking at that at the moment. And the reason we can do it is because we're independent, so we're not for profit. We have integrity, we're for purpose, we have authority as a consequence, and we can govern it. So we can actually create norms and enforce. But for that to happen, people have to avail themselves of it. So we can't say our standard is the global standard and nothing else can avail. Those who wish to actually be governed can allow themselves to be governed by us.
Okay.
And that's what we do.
And those who wish to be governed within this framework, how do you enforce?
Well, there's dispute provisions, there are accountabilities which will come through. We have in our international courts of arbitration.
Yep.
There's different sizes of disputes. We have the capacity to have mediation, all those sorts of things.
Yep.
When you had internet naming rights disputes, we settle those sorts of things.
Okay.
So it's an interesting, I suppose it's a unique model,
yeah,
that's all. And the only reason we are able to, propose it is because we've maintained our this purpose-led independence throughout. And so it's just sort of interesting that, from an abstract point of view, I run the show, so of course I have an active engagement, but just sitting back being a little abstract about it, it's quite an unusual situation to be in. Because you think about that 45 million, we're also politically neutral. So last week at our centennial,
really unique position.
Yeah,
isn't it?
So it's almost like a, funnily enough, like a United Nations for business, which is has positive and negative connotations. But we take the view that you choose, you lose.
Yeah.
So we don't choose any side in this. We simply enable business worldwide.
Yeah.
And so last week at our centennial, we actually had ICC Iran, ICC US, ICC Syria, ICC Turkey.
Yeah.
They're all in the same room.
Yeah.
What unites them is not necessarily around the geopolitics.
Yeah.
It's a genuine belief that the only way global commerce can operate is if there's actually norms and standards which are actually people held accountable to.
Yeah.
And there's transparency attached, and the organization that can deliver that, because of its independence and authority, is the ICC. So it is actually a unique position.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm kind of celebrating it a bit, obviously, because it's our centenary.
Yeah.
But what we're thinking at the moment is, what will we look back on in 2219 and say were the inflection points in global commerce that we created or forced or enabled in the 21st century. We can look back on the 20th century, Incoterms, General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, private commercial arbitration, I can go on a list of it. And these have actually transformed or changed the way in which global commerce operated.
Mm.
So in 100 years, what will we look back on and say that's what we influenced? So we're very interested in this issue around digital, how we actually enable business through it, which, you know, on one level you might say, well, that's self-evident, it should be. But if I could, what we're trying to do at the moment is democratize access to blockchain, enable trust to actually be accorded to data management, all these sorts of things, all of which we can do. We just need to sort of scope out the specific problems that we think will make it, the pain points for business, etc. And we are very interested in particular, as we're the worldwide business organization, in enabling those businesses, particularly in least developed countries and developing countries, because we actually think an enabled private sector is a force for good. An enabled private sector's got to have active business participants. Active business participants, when they're actually deployed as SMEs and micro SMEs and they function, it's a very good way of supercharging economic development.
Yep.
So how do we help them? So we think digital can be helped. We think enabling access to that is going to be important. Obviously, building private sector environments which are conducive to growth is all very important to us. Developing human capital, all these sorts of things. So we're looking at all that, how we can really help.
Okay. And what we might do is skip back to what brought you personally into this position of global oversight of the ICC. I mean, what's your background?
I haven't really been helpful in the way you'd normally run this interview,
have
I? Because I've sort of jumped into substance without peripheral.
That's all good.
So it was all a series of happenstances. So my first career, I was a diplomat. So I worked in Moscow, in the multilateral system. So I worked in the United Nations. I was a negotiator on law of the sea. I worked in development. That's why I was in Bangladesh.
Yep.
So I worked with the World Bank when I was there. I was chargé d'affaires in Baghdad in the 91 Gulf crisis.
Yeah.
I've had some interesting experiences. It was along the way. And then I became a private lawyer. So my wife is an actor, actually. So Jane Turner, who's pretty well known as Catherine Kim in Australia.
Oh, of course.
She was working out of Melbourne and Australia. It was very difficult for her to work overseas. So I, in the end, decided that it was easier for me to change jobs than it was for her.
So you switched from being a diplomat in Baghdad
to a lawyer. And
interesting change.
Yeah, it was interesting, actually. And then, I then spent a considerable period of my next career working at one law firm, Coors. So I was senior partner there for 20 years. But in the mix of time that I was at Coors, I actually got very heavily involved in things that really mattered to clients. Public policy became more important. Engagement with Asia became very important, so I got involved with all these sorts of things.
That's Coors' sort of specialty.
Coors is like what's called a client-driven law firm. So what really mattered to Coors was always what was actually the top of mind for its clients. And when you sort of look at it, there's specific issues, but thematically, geopolitical uncertainty was a concern, regulatory framework, all sorts of stuff, engagement with Asia. So I got involved in those sorts of issues. So I was one of the co-drafters of the Australia and the Asian Century white paper with Ken Henry. So I was appointed to cabinet to do that.
Okay.
With Ken and Peter Drysdale and Catherine Livingston. That's right.
And for the listeners who don't know about that paper?
So that was the paper which sought to envisage a roadmap for Australia and engagement with Asia in this century.
Yeah.
And it was actually achieved bipartisan support, but it created a positive incentive to change.
Yep.
It was actually an economic reform narrative. It provided a positive narrative as to why Australia should continue to reform economically, because to engage with Asia, we had to be economically strong. So, I mean, there's lots of other stuff in it, but it was a very interesting piece of work. And sort of a level of focus on it waxes and wanes, but the underlying thesis still exists, which is engagement with Asia is the critical priority in terms of economic opportunity for Australia.
For you, for listeners, I think the listener base is probably 80% European, but they're fully aware that I'm an Australian. I'm speaking to another Australian here who's...
Well, it's very nice to talk to somebody. One of the things I find interesting in Europe is that it's almost impossible to have a substantive conversation on Asia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And one thing I found fascinating since I've been in Paris, the number of people who seek me out because their knowledge, particularly of China, is very superficial. And yet the challenge of China and understanding how to work with and the complexity of China is something that, in a way, Australians aren't bad at because 23-25% of our economy is exposed.
Yep.
And I've been going to China since 85.
Yeah.
I'm not Kevin Rudd. But I've been engaged for a long time with China.
I'll have to introduce you, just as a side note, once we finish the podcast, to Ambrosetti House and Paola Borsata. That's a think tank. It's one of the top think tanks in Italy and indeed Europe. But I was at a summit recently, a China European summit.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very, I mean, the level of talks, as you know, some of these summits are a bit too superficial, but some of the levels of talks were quite substantial. So. Yeah.
So I got involved in lots of stuff, and at one stage I was chairing finance and economics at the Asia Pacific Economic Community Business Advisory Council, and then I was one of the founders of the B20, which is the business movement attached to the G20. Mm-hmm. Long story short, in my engagement all those areas, suddenly brought me into, I suppose, focus or contact with ICC, but with the then executive board, and the chair at the time was Terry McGraw, who's the part of the McGraw-Hill family in the US. And so he asked me to join the board. I got involved at a board level, found it very interesting. And then there was a change here and I was going to become the chairman. And then they asked me if I'd be interested in being considered as this CEO, basically, Secretary General. I thought, well, actually, bearing in mind our earlier part of the conversation, there's some really unique features of this organization, if properly aligned and positioned, we could really do some seriously good stuff for people. And that's what it would be fun to do.
I want to drill down on that because I remember we connected on LinkedIn and there was you had some reflections, and I've got them there in front of me on my smartphone from the United Nations, the UNGA, I think it was in October last year.
That's right.
And one thing that sticks out to me is global governance, and this ties in nicely with security as well. I mean, you know, having good governance and strong, robust, legislative, enforceable governance frameworks ensures security, at least across, you know, in technology, but also in other areas as well, in trade. So what were your takeaways from?
Well, I mean, I suppose I was pretty underwhelmed. You know, look, it's not my first occasion with the United Nations, and in a way, I'm a believer and adherent to the concept of the United Nations, but its operational capacity is challenged.
Yeah.
That being said, I mean, we at the International Chamber of Commerce, we're the first private sector organisation to be given observer status at the United Nations.
That's mind with you, the World Bank and...
No, we're private sector. So we're there as the private sector voice.
Yeah.
We have observer status, which enables us to participate in the General Assembly debates and actually in all the various accredited. I mean, there's likely sort of protocol issues. For example, so the human rights and business debate in Geneva.
Yeah.
So we actually, we have a seat, we have a right to be heard and to speak. But the interesting thing there was it took the UN, and probably not unreasonably, because they hadn't really focused on this in terms of the development agenda, it took them a good 50 years to work out that they needed to actually engage with the private sector. But what is interesting is that the only body that they knew could do that was actually the ICC. So we are now in there. So they talk about a partnership with the private sector by working with the ICC.
How long is that partnership?
18 months.
18
but,
months.
But what I think they thought, they would just tick a box and say, we've got the private sector there and then move on.
Yeah.
But what they're discovering is that we actually...
Add value.
We actually want to add some value.
Yeah.
And that's confronting to a number of people because, frankly, you know, there's a lot of inertia which underlines or undermines actually the effectiveness of the UN. You can have endlessly interesting conversations with endlessly interesting people without much happening. Whereas just from a business perspective, I'm much more outcome focused.
Yeah, yeah.
And so pushing, and we don't go away.
No.
So we're there. It's a very interesting kind of model.
Yeah.
So yeah. I was very, but at the General Assembly last year, so I was there for the high level political week, and it's an honour. I mean, we are sort of seated at the same table as all the heads of government, heads of state who are there. You'd have to say the lack of ambition of the leaders was actually pretty palpable, particularly the lack of ambition on trying to think through new forms of governance in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you think about the new business models, the new economic models, the reshaping of geography, demography. There's nothing wrong with principles of accountability, transparency, etc., which actually underpins good governance, but that needs to be rethought in the current context. More voice needs to be allowed to areas that were not traditionally part of it. I mean, the classic is if you look at the voting weighting in the World Bank or the IMF, etc., it's still geared very much to post-Second World War ascendancies.
Yeah.
Whereas now you have a different different balance of economic power.
Yeah.
How should that be reflected?
Yeah.
Should people just do what they're told? Or do they have a right to be consulted? And if they don't, have an opportunity, if the institutions don't transform, will they just create their own? Hey, well, is that the AIIB? I mean, is that the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement? Is it? So are you saying to see shadow forms emerge, contours emerge? So the reform of the global governance or the enlightened, the, ensuring global governance is fit for purpose in the 21st century is pretty important, I would say. And we think the private sector has a say in that.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's why we're getting more interest. I mean, I've always participated in security discussions.
Yeah.
People often thought it's really weird to have a business person here. But if you think about it, a lot of military security is only determined on the basis of economic strength.
Mm.
And economic strength comes from the ability of the private sector to actually function effectively. There is kind of like a direct line.
Yeah.
It's not accidental. Though a lot of the security people cannot believe that business people have anything to add in these discussions because they don't understand business, basically.
I agree. And
that's actually part of the current debate in Australia-China, where the security guys say basically, the business people just want to cozy up to China and what they call them panda huggers.
Yeah.
And they're not hard-headed like we are. Absolute, complete bullshit. Mm. They have just no conception of their genuine interests of business.
Yep.
And businesses' interests are aligned with national interests.
Yeah.
They're not dissonant.
Yeah. I think it's because of the layers of complexity, sometimes if people are very much focused on their industry sector or their industry sector, sometimes it's a bit more difficult to step back and see the bigger picture, which I think if you have had the experiences that you've had, you can really appreciate that bigger picture.
But I mean, you would notice this in security discussions, there's a level of inertia that operates in those discussions as well, where people are used to the positions they've held, not just their personal positions, but the actual intellectual positions or the security positions they've held. And they can actually sometimes hold them for too long, particularly when the context has changed, and they then seek to recreate the context to enable their positions to continue to be valid.
One interesting phenomenon is, the current debate about the use of different technology in supply chain. Regardless of whether there is proof or not, of certain companies implanting certain things in certain devices, whether it's a null and void argument is probably the more important component of that discussion. And you see the inertia of narrative sweep away even the most determined fighters for more of a pragmatic understanding or a pragmatic, stance within the argument, and they can get swept away too, through sheer inertia. It's a really interesting discussion in sort of some of the countries that sit within the Five Eyes Agreement. There's one stance which is quite strong, driven by the United States, and then in Europe it's slightly different tone, but they're talking about the same issues within supply chain. So that's a fascinating thing, and I guess a question to you as well to tie in the security theme. You sit in an independent scenario in the ICC and you have people from the table who are from, you know, the Chinese Chamber of Commerce, the Iranian Chamber of Commerce, Syrian Chamber of Commerce, what I find fascinating and encouraging even, it makes me optimistic, is the fact that these dialogues still are still there, are still evident, and are, if anything, even more fertile than they were before.
I'm a great believer in second track anyway. And I'm having created a couple of second track plays in my time in Australia. Part of our job, in a way, is there will be geopolitical disputes and frictions from time to time. But the power of the second track is you can keep the dialogue going. With Indonesia and Australia, with China and Australia, we can go on, and so it's an important element. There are enough common interests in, and not just business community, but also civil society and non-government players, so academics, etc., properly harnessed, that can enable the relationship at a level to continue, which is then available. And also it's a way of actually having discussions without having discussions.
Because you got multiple.
Which can move things along.
You got multiple threads, and if one or two of those threads are being plucked, you've still got this bedrock. It's interesting. There was a form of
contact is actually important. Contact is just shows. But on the business side, it's actually quite interesting. So there is genuine interest in the kind of tools we create, like we talk about Incoterms. We have this thing called ATA Kano, which probably sounds extremely kind of esoteric, but put in a really practical way, we enable this the customs world to be real. So if you're a rock band, if you're a rock band, you're going on a tour, you're going to be subject to different customs and duties as you go in and out.
Yep.
We can enable, because of the high trust and integrity we have, the application of an instrument called an ATA Kane, which can simplify that whole process.
For rock bands specifically?
No, it's in general. It's more using the example.
The musician in me was thinking,
because you've got all this band equipment, which you can actually then get an ATA Kane, which can help manage it.
Yeah.
And similarly with art exhibitions. I mean, I'm using the two most sort of immediately recognizable new stuff moves around, but it applies in other areas as well. So we can join together Russia there with America. There, developing countries. It's in everyone's interest for that to work.
Absolutely.
And people buy into our governance to enable them to happen, not pay, but actually they join our governance to enable them to participate. That's fascinating.
It's really, there was a former guest who I had on, Martin van der Beek, who set up the FEDRA-ADAR, the cybercrime unit for serious organized crime in Holland. And his first port of call was to the FSB in Russia. And that the relationship that have still exists today in certain departments, because surprise, surprise, they both are very much interested in breaking down serious organized crime.
Yeah.
You know, these types of, and so you've got these multiple layers. And I think, you know, this, interestingly, the podcast, the listeners on this podcast vary from, you know, people in higher level of politics and military, et cetera, down to the general audience. And I try and make it work for both. The sad fact is that many people in the general audience may not understand, you know, the very simple facts that not everyone is sort of pigeonholed in this country, as you know, as is blatantly obvious. And yet,
well, I mean, from time to time you have mutual interests. So when I was a Law of the Sea negotiator, Australia did not recognise Cuba, and yet we used to work in coalition with Cuba because we had a particular interest.
Yeah,
which was we didn't want the deep seabed mined.
Yeah,
because the risk of it happening was it would have been done in an uncommercial, uneconomic way, which would have destroyed the price of vital minerals in Australia. We're not the only ones who had an interest in that.
Perfect example.
The Cubans did as well. We work with the Zambians. It was actually from time to time you find mutual interest.
Yeah,
and what you can do with that mutual interest is grow it into other areas if need be, but also enables contact. It's fascinating. I mean, you don't. Multilateralism is much frowned upon or sort of argued against by many people, but how do you think the mail gets delivered? How do you think planes are able to cross the globe?
Yeah.
Multilateral agreements. Yeah. Though I do see IPUs under a bit of threat at the moment as well by President Trump. So look, yeah, I'm very glad for the opportunity to actually have a chat. I mean, I know this has probably been a little more disjointed than some of them.
Not at all. No. I think we tied it in nicely. Yeah. And we're both conscious of the time, so that we can end there. And on the final note being mutual interests are always good.
Well, finding mutual interest and then using that to actually grow it out. Which is really, that's how you develop a pretty substantive relationship. Mm. And you always want to have multiple contact points, I think. So I look forward to seeing you at the Munich Security Talks next year.
Look forward to it. Thank you so much.
See you soon. Thanks a lot, mate. Thank you.